Clark Kent picked the wrong moment to go to the water cooler.
Kent! Today's your lucky day.
He straightened just in time to see Perry White lugging a swollen canvas mailbag across the bullpen.
I need somebody to take over the Lorna for the Lovelorn column.
Lorna Behawick, who wrote the Planet's personal advice column, had just gone into the hospital for gallbladder surgery and would be recovering for at least a month, maybe two. Clark had already sent her a small flower arrangement and a get-well-soon card.
But, Mr. White, I wouldn't have the foggiest idea how to give advice on relationships.
Lois! Kent needs your help understanding women and their problems. You're a woman. Give him suggestions on how to write Lorna's column.
Just because I'm a woman, that means I'm an expert on women's problems? I'm a reporter, Chief, not a psychiatrist.
Besides, surely all the letters aren't from women. A few must come from men.
We don't publish letters from whining men. It's embarrassing. The two of you have worked together before, and I need that column.
But, Mr. White, the Korean War Veterans Parade is today.
Olsen can cover that. I just need pictures. No excuses. You're the reporters, I'm the editor.
Perry lobbed the bulky mailbag.
And this is your assignment. We'll still run it under Lorna's byline. Nobody needs to know she's in the hospital.
Sorry, but I've got an interview scheduled. Confidential source about Luther Corp, remember? Clark, you're on your own for this one. Look, Clark, all you really need is a soft heart. You're halfway there already. And I promise I'll help. Just not right now.
All right, I'll give it my best.
Clark didn't need X-ray vision to realize that the satchel contained hundreds of letters. The only saving grace was that he would get to spend more time with Lois. He had admired her from the first day he'd walked into the Daily Planet with his original story about Superman. Lois was as different from anyone in Smallville as the moon was from the sun. He felt like a small-town boy whenever he was with her. He couldn't help but blush anytime she paid him attention. Clark carried the heavy sack of letters back to his desk and dropped it on the floor beside his rolling chair. He pulled out a letter, read it, set it aside, and reached for the next one. He was quickly overwhelmed.
I'm sure my husband is cheating on me. Should I confront him? Should I forgive him? My boyfriend keeps hitting me, even though I know he doesn't mean it. My friends tell me to leave him, but I love him. What should I do? My husband doesn't like my cooking.
Letter after letter left him mystified. He could bend steel girders with his bare hands, outrace a speeding locomotive, fly from one side of the country to the other faster than the most advanced fighter jet. But this? He had no idea. For the rest of the day, Clark felt he was reading the same basic letters over and over. These people posed difficult questions and had deep emotional problems that couldn't be solved by simply twisting steel or outracing a bullet. He thought about going to visit Lorna in the hospital to ask her advice on giving advice. How did she deal with this every day? Clark tried to imagine the conversation in the sterile hospital room, with him awkwardly attempting to discuss love with an older spinster who, despite being single, still knew a lot about the human heart. In fact, everyone seemed to know more about the human heart than he did. Clark had a deep-seated desire to help people, and he'd never questioned his own motives or feelings on the matter. To him, it was the obvious thing to do whenever he saw someone in need. Until today, he had always felt he could overcome any challenge. But now he thought perhaps he was wrong. Helping people overcome emotional pain and suffering was obviously a lot more difficult than exhibiting feats of strength. Still, in a different way, by answering these letters, he would also be doing something important for people in need. But he couldn't do it alone. Blanche Rosen was a 48-year-old widow whose husband had been killed in the Korean War. Though she'd worked on various factory assembly lines for 20 years, and the last five at Luther Corp with an exemplary performance record, Blanche suddenly found herself jobless. Lex Luthor had systematically removed all of his female and older male employees, and as he put it, put a man in a man's job. It had happened previously in American industry, particularly after World War II. With the overseas war wrapped up and all the men returning home, many women had found themselves booted out of the factories and sent back to become homemakers. But with no such flood of returning soldiers now, Luther Corp's deliberate action really stuck in Lois's craw. Worse, Blanche Rosen's surreptitious message strongly implied that something more sinister was going on. Lois was doing some digging, but so far she couldn't find anyone else willing to talk. In fact, she could find few of the fired Luther Corp employees at all. It was very fishy indeed. Lois waited in a bright red Naugahyde booth. She'd arranged to meet her source for coffee at a Canal Street diner. Exactly on time, a severe-looking woman arrived and took the seat across from her. She wore a nice dress, perhaps her best, the one reserved for Temple on Saturdays.
Are you Lois Lane?
Yes, I am. I'm the one who can get your story told, Mrs. Rosen.
It's not only my story. There's a lot of women and men just like me from Luther Corp, but most of them aren't alive anymore.
Are you saying Lex Luthor killed them?
In a manner of speaking. Hazardous duty, no safety procedures or equipment, harmful radiation exposures, Caribbean vacations. I'm one of the last few left, mainly because I'm a tough old bird.
I'm all ears, Mrs. Rosen.
And what are you ladies having today?
Just coffee, thanks.
I'll have coffee. And a pastrami on rye with potato chips.
You got it.
And, wrap up a second one to go. You don't mind, do you, news girl?
A girl's gotta eat.
Okie doke.
But you have to sing for your supper.
Blanche looked around the diner, studying the other customers.
How do I know you're not in Luther's pocket?
That's not an image I want to think about. Frankly, Mrs. Rosen, Lex Luthor makes my skin crawl. I've been face to face with him. I've seen him smile. There's nothing behind it. Nothing.
Here's your coffee, girls.
Thanks.
The things I've seen, Miss Lane. Luthor Corp and their munitions factories. The military bases. The test flights. Secret programs that don't show up on any official paperwork. I had a security clearance. I performed the most delicate work. And now look at me. Crumpled up and discarded like a chewing gum wrapper. Practically living on the streets, without a job, without a pension. My husband's death benefits almost gone. It's a damn shame, I tell you. Forget what Senator McCarthy rails about. This is un-American. This is not what my family left Germany for.
What kind of work did you do exactly? And what's this about a Caribbean vacation?
Reactor assembly. Luther has his own island, complete with a small atomic power reactor.
Lois took notes in shorthand.
Is that where he works on his secret projects for the government?
Miss Lane, the government doesn't know half of what Luther does. That uncharted island is a testbed for some of his most dangerous technology. Once Luther's weapons systems function, he'll sell them to the U.S. military for 10 times his investment.
So how did you get involved?
He invited some of his employees to help build facilities there and do the technical work. He hired Cuban locals to do the heavy construction of remodeling an old fort into a new base. You know, many of those men and women were just like me. Divorced people and widows living on a shoestring without much to keep us here in Metropolis. When we got the offer to spend a few months in the Caribbean, who were we to complain? At the time, it didn't occur to us that we were the employees Luther considered the most expendable, the ones who wouldn't be missed.
I see.
But then they started getting sick. The Cuban work crews left and we didn't see them again. I heard something about their boats sinking in open water, all souls lost. On the island, those poor men and women in charge of installing reactor fuel rods and coolant systems all got real sick. And Luther, what a sweetheart he was, took them to his own hospitals back on the mainland. He said he would provide the best possible medical treatment. They're all dead now.
Here you go, pastrami on rye.
Thanks. Apparently, there was a radiation leak. All the hair fell out. I heard Luther make jokes about them being bald. I haven't shown any symptoms yet, but Luther swept all of us under the rug.
Do you have any proof of this, Mrs. Rosen?
No. They took everything from me. I have no records, no photos, nothing tangible. But I'll tell you what. You'll find everything you need in the Luther Corp munitions factory in the Barrens outside of Metropolis. And I can tell you how a smart, resourceful reporter might be able to slip inside and take a look around.
Gotham City's most illustrious citizens attended Bruce Wayne's famous parties, and ample front-page coverage in the Gotham Times Society section went without saying. Sparing no expense, Bruce always centered these soirees around an important humanitarian cause. Though most of the celebrities and important personages attended just to be seen, they also brought their checkbooks. The glitterati included Gotham's most prominent citizens, as well as celebrity guests. Movie stars, singers, and sports personalities, including Rock Hudson, David Niven, Buddy Holly, Paul Anka, and Sugar Ray Robinson. The quiet, revered star of the show was Eleanor Roosevelt, the former First Lady, who had turned her considerable energies to supporting the cause of polio research. Though he changed promptly into his finest tuxedo, Bruce didn't step through the entry doors until he considered himself fashionably late. When he finally descended the grand staircase, moving with an air of casual mystery, all conversation stopped.
"Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to my humble abode."
Alfred appeared immediately with a tray bearing a martini glass and his specially mixed Vesper, in reality a bit of lemon peel and chilled ice water.
"Tonight I offer you an opportunity to be generous. Countless poor children around the world are crippled by polio. The medical research and new vaccine of Dr. Salk shows great promise, and we must not let him lack for resources."
He nodded toward Eleanor Roosevelt, who stood stoic and proud, like visiting royalty.
"You all know my personal reasons for wanting to rid humanity of this terrible scourge. My late husband would have congratulated Mr. Wayne for his efforts, and I congratulate you all for being here. Please help fight this disease with the weapons you all wield, your checkbooks."
"Let's show Mrs. Roosevelt the generosity and vision of Gotham City. Tonight, we can make our mark on the world. A mark that begins with a dollar sign."
"Bruce, dear, you have more money than all of us combined."
A dusky, lithe, and beautiful woman came up behind Bruce, as if to take possession.
"For the cost of this party, you could have made a substantial donation of your own."
"I intend to do both, Selina. After you all make your donations, Wayne Enterprises will match the total dollar for dollar. So if you'd like to make me dig deep into my pockets, dig deeply into yours."
"At that rate, you'll fund a cure for polio in a single night."
"Oh, don't worry, Mr. Cobblepot. I'm sure we can find other worthy causes. All of you, please, enjoy yourselves."
Alfred ran the manor household and serving staff like a militia. No tray of hors d'oeuvres was allowed to circulate half empty. Glasses of wine and champagne always had to be filled. Cuban cigars and Turkish cigarettes were offered in ornate silver cases. Selina Kyle slipped her arm through his and walked along smoothly beside Bruce as he worked his way through clusters of the rich and famous, shaking hands, trying not to spend too much time with any one person or group.
"We really should see more of each other, Bruce."
"I'd like that, Selina, but I'm afraid I have to be the social butterfly tonight. I am the host of this thing."
"Ah, yes. Well, we'll talk soon, I'm sure."
Selina accepted the brush off with a flirtatious smile and disappeared back into the crowd. The conversations generally had nothing to do with polio. Bruce repeatedly heard the excited buzz about the so-called Superman from Metropolis. Gotham Police Commissioner Loeb, a corrupt man at the top of a blue pyramid of corrupt officers, delighted in talking about strangeness in another city rather than the problems of his own.
"Ah, but Gotham has its own costumed maniac. Maybe the Batman has alien superpowers too, eh, Commissioner? That would explain why your men can never catch him."
"Superman's a hero. Saves children from burning buildings in broad daylight. The Batman slinks around at night, evades arrest, and assaults on-duty officers. He's nothing but another criminal. We have 29 pending charges against him, and that's just for starters. He's Gotham's number one most wanted."
"You're just upset, Commissioner, because you can't make the Batman one of your financial contributors."
"I will not be insulted by a petty gangster in an ill-fitting top hat and tails."
"I am a respectable nightclub owner, sir."
"Respectable?
And what is your opinion on the Batman, Mr. Wayne?"
Bruce turned from Cobblepot and Loeb.
"He baffles me, Miss Monroe. He dresses for a costume party, but there aren't any cocktails being served." "Speaking of which, time to freshen my drink."
Bruce melted away again, seeking Alfred.
"Here you are."
"Merely escorting Mr. Hudson to his automobile. He has an early shoot."
"How much longer, Alfred?"
"The evening has barely begun, Master Bruce. Chin up."
All for the greater good, I suppose. You are marking the glasses carefully when you collect the empty drinks?"
"Indeed, sir. You'll have plenty of new specimens for your crime lab tomorrow. Tonight, you must play your part and socialize with your adoring public, no matter how difficult it may be for you."
"Yes, Alfred."
With a wry expression and freshened faux Vesper, Bruce returned to the social fray. For him, the event was a chance to gather data on some of the wealthiest people in Gotham society, so that he could analyze the information in his secret lab the next day. But for tonight, he had his role to play.
What's news, everybody?
At his desk, Clark was buried in letters, still not sure which ones to answer or how. When Lois noticed him, she paused, her face showing a sudden and unexpected warmth.
Oh, were you working all night on that, Clark?
Oh, hi, Lois. I went home, but I didn't stop thinking about it. I'm a fish out of water with this stuff. I sure could use your advice.
You're a sweet guy, Clark, but not what I'd call wise in the ways of the world. I don't know what the chief was thinking giving you that assignment.
Well, he did suggest that we work together. What kind of advice can I give these people?
Lois spent a minute reading the handwritten pages, her face tightening and her frown deepening.
I see what you mean. These women don't really want to do the work to solve their problems. They just want someone to commiserate with them. If you give them an honest answer, they won't want to hear it. So you've got to give them the right answer instead.
The right answer isn't the honest answer?
Trust me. Just look at the letters. Here. Her boyfriend keeps beating her and she goes back to him every time? I'd like to give that guy a knuckle sandwich myself, see how he likes a taste of his own medicine. Then again, even if she left him, that woman would probably find someone just the same or worse. I know the type, Clark. If they knew how to find the strength within themselves to see their own worth, then they wouldn't let men take advantage of them, much less write letters complaining about it. Unfortunately, they've gotten themselves in up to their necks, and they just expect some hero to swoop in and magically save them.
You mean like Superman?
He's the exception.
She was obviously embarrassed, but a bashful smile crept across her face.
If only there were more exceptions like him. Do your best, Clark. You're good at showing compassion. Just be yourself.
Would you read over the draft before I turn it into Mr. White? I'll buy you a cup of coffee.
It's a deal.
Clark watched her go, not sure whether or not he'd actually asked her out for a date. He faced his task once more, wanting to do a good job. He still didn't understand these problems, but he thought of someone who might.
Yeah?
Yeah, excuse me, Mr. White. I'm feeling a little under the weather. I'd like to take the rest of the day off, please.
Well, all right. I need your call by tomorrow, Kent. No excuses.
You'll have it, Mr. White. I'll be back at my desk in the morning, I promise.
A playboy like Bruce was expected to sleep in after a party, and the doors of his bedroom suite remained locked for hours. While armies of housekeepers and cleaning staff restored the manor to its quiet grace, however, Bruce got up early and descended through a secret passage to the cave where he could do his research. Alfred had been careful to collect at least one item from each guest and tag every specimen, identifying the user. When the glasses were dusted, the fingerprints came out quite clearly, and Bruce spent an hour photographing them so that he could add them to his detailed library and catalog the results. By now, his fingerprint collection must have rivaled that of the Gotham City Police Department. He had no way to tell when or if the information might become vital for an investigation. But his mind was elsewhere, focused on a much more challenging riddle. Ever since the first appearance of Superman, Bruce had been intrigued by the man's amazing powers, and the previous night's party gossip had only sharpened his interest. Now he hunched in his large chair and pondered. Next to the blinking lights of his computer banks with spinning reel-to-reel tapes, a set of rounded cathode ray tubes projected images and information. He had watched newsreel footage of Superman's exploits. He'd studied photographs, newspaper clippings, eyewitness accounts. Even though most photographs were motion blur due to Superman's incredible speed, the hero wore no mask, as if confident that his identity would remain a secret. Bruce couldn't understand how a mere man accomplished so many amazing things. Superman had hefted a huge, sinking passenger ship with ease and set it down safely in the Metropolis Harbor. Another time, he'd burst from a burning building with a child in each arm as flames raged all around. The children were coughing and gasping, but largely unharmed. The fire hadn't singed a hair on Superman's head. Bruce had studied photographs of Superman cornering a group of gangsters. With their backs to a brick wall, they brandished Tommy guns and unleashed a hail of bullets, which bounced harmlessly from the big S emblem on his chest. Bruce had used magnifiers to study every image, but he couldn't figure out the trick. What sort of fabric could deflect bullets so perfectly, so painlessly? Even with the best-known bulletproof technology on his armored Batman suit, he still felt bullet impacts like the blows of a hammer. And what about Superman's heat vision?
Some sort of laser built directly into his optic nerves?
His strength was incredible. He bent iron girders in his bare hands.
The uniform must be augmented somehow. With what? Reinforced fibers? Pulleys? Hydraulics?
Superman flew through the air, but beneath the cape there was no room for a hidden jetpack, and none of the images showed any indication of exhaust or rocket flames. Where did the man get such technology? Lois Lane at the Daily Planet would have the world believe he was an alien with extraordinary inhuman powers, but Bruce didn't buy that for a second. Carefully dividing the problem into several apparently unrelated parts, he had slipped technical challenges into the workload of Wayne Enterprises' divisions, but so far his crack scientists had yielded no answers. Even they couldn't come close to what this costumed hero did on a routine basis. Only one other U.S. company approached the technological innovation of Wayne Enterprises. Could Superman actually be a Luther Corp creation? An experimental soldier? So far, Luther had been curiously silent on the matter of Superman, making only offhand skeptical statements about the so-called hero who had walked onto the stage with his grandstanding exploits. That alone made Bruce suspicious that Luther was behind Superman himself, or at the very least, deeply engaged in an investigation of his own.
Pardon me, sir?
Alfred wore a singed and stained laboratory coat and insulated black rubber gloves. Protective goggles hung on a strap from his neck. Leaving the household staff to continue their work, the butler often assisted Bruce in his large-scale experiments. On a test rack in a side grotto, he had fired up a set of small, self-contained rockets designed to be installed in a jetpack. The gauges recorded stresses, thrust, stabilization.
I'm afraid that these bulky jets have the thrust to carry a person through the air, Master Bruce, but not smoothly or with any precision. Even with a more compact design, the pack would require a full body support framework and fireproof materials, practically a suit of armor.
That won't do. Superman moves with flexibility and speed.
Bruce had also given the problems to the Applied Technologies Division, and Director Houston had accepted the task, but he had not expected to find an easy solution.
I'm beginning to doubt that we'll get a handle on Superman's abilities anytime soon. The more questions I ask, the fewer answers I get.
Have you considered, Master Bruce, the possibility that Superman may be exactly who he says he is? That he does indeed come from another planet?
It's not a rational suggestion at this point, Alfred. There has to be some other answer.
Alfred chucked off the thick gloves and removed his lab garments to reveal incongruously formal garb underneath. Bruce was sure that few other scientists wore a tuxedo sans jacket beneath a white lab coat.
It is time that I oversee the household staff. A far more difficult job than this, if you ask me, sir. You will be pleased to know, sir, that I've arranged to have a conversation with Richard Drayling later this afternoon, as you requested. Based on our longtime friendship, I believe Mr. Drayling does want someone to confide in. He and I are of an age, and we'll talk casually of old times, of your father, and of why he felt the need to resign from your board of directors.
Thank you, Alfred. If there's something going on at Wayne Enterprises, then I need to know about it. Let's hope we can solve that mystery at least.
Smallville was halfway across the country, but a man who could outrace a supersonic jet covered the distance in no time. After crossing the Great Plains, looking down at the colorful checkerboard of crops, he found his beloved Kansas town. When he saw that the Smallville Cemetery was empty, he alighted there first, just to have some time alone. The grave was immaculate, the vase on a stand filled with fresh-cut flowers, bright yellow daffodils and scarlet tulips, signs of spring. His father had always loved spring, planting season, time to ready the soil for a new year. Clark had been a one-man army on the farm, helping Jonathan Kent. Now that his mother was all alone, she didn't even try to handle all the acreage. Martha had her garden, her chickens, and her house. The rest of the land she leased to neighboring farmers, the Hubbards and the Schmidts. Kal-El knelt by the headstone. Jonathan Kent, faithful husband, loving father, you were our greatest strength. His vision shimmered a little. Jonathan Kent had been a man of few but wise words, and now no words were needed. The silence felt comforting rather than empty. For hours and hours, Clark and his father had done their chores, baled hay, planted crops, fixed the fence line, without needing to reassure each other with incessant conversation. When his father did decide to make a comment, it was bound to be important.
If you don't need to say anything, there's really no need to talk. These days, with their radio programs and phonograph records, people forget the virtues of an hour of good, quiet thinking.
Though he knew his true name was Kal-El, here in Smallville, especially at his father's grave, he would always be Clark Kent. It didn't matter what he learned about the destruction of Krypton or his biological father, Jor-El. It didn't matter that he was the only one of his kind on Earth. Here in Smallville, he would never be alone. He closed his eyes and remained quiet. Jonathan Kent had always understood Clark's thoughts, even when they remained unspoken. In the farmhouse kitchen, Clark didn't need super senses to detect the aromatic cinnamon, sweet sugar, and tart Cortland apples.
Welcome home, son. You're just in time.
Apple pie. You always seem to have one ready, Ma.
There's coffee in the percolator and a jug of whole milk in the icebox for you. You go on into your room and change while I cut you a big slice of pie. That nice Pete Ross comes around to check on me at least once a week. He'd love to see Clark Kent, but it wouldn't do for him to catch a glimpse of Superman at my kitchen table.
Martha was just scooping a generous slice of pie onto an aqua Milmac plate when Clark returned wearing an old plaid shirt and dungarees. She'd cut herself a much smaller wedge and settled into her chair at the formica-topped kitchen table.
So how is Pete these days?
Oh, still running the general store. Still talking about heading out into the world and making his fortune someday.
And still not doing anything about it?
That boy has never driven across the county line, as far as I know.
They chatted about his daily work at the newspaper, his apartment in Metropolis, the new gladiola she had ordered from the seed catalog, which would really spruce up her flower garden. But Martha wasn't fooled.
Something's troubling you, Clark. What is it? You didn't come here in the middle of the week just to chat with your old mother.
I missed you, Ma.
I know that's not technically a lie, Clark. But you didn't answer me.
Perry has me filling in on the Lorna for the Lovelorn column while she's recuperating from a hospital procedure. And I think I'm in over my head, Ma. So many people have so many problems, and I don't know how to solve them all. I don't know what to tell them.
Oh, Clark, for a man of steel, you've got a heart of gold.
I'm not from Earth, I'm from Krypton, and I'm the only one of my kind. What if I never understand this world, and this world never understands me?
Do you think most of us really understand each other? If the troubles of people could be so easily fixed, then nobody would be jumping out of windows. No marriage would end in divorce. No crime would ever be committed. But that isn't the world we live in. So we have to do our best to make it a better place. And believe you me, son, you do far more than your share.
But I can do so much more, Ma. From the moment I first put on that suit, I've been helping people in danger, stopping criminals, preventing accidents. But people need to be saved every hour of every day. How many car wrecks have happened in the time I've been here talking to you? How many robberies? How many shootings? And it's narrow-minded for me to worry only about crimes committed in Metropolis. What about the whole world? Couldn't I prevent wars, stop slavery, divert rivers and prevent drought, distribute food and stop hunger? I could work every second, and still the job wouldn't be done.
Your father used to talk like that when he saw how much work needed to be done around the farm. Thought it would never get done. And yet it did.
Here I am in your kitchen as mild-mannered Clark Kent. But what business do I have trying to lead a normal life? Doesn't the world need Superman to be a hero 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
Clark, you're entitled to your own life. You deserve to get to know people, all kinds of people. Maybe then problems like the ones in those letters you're reading won't be such a mystery to you. Pay more attention to your friends, your relationships. Spend time with your pal Jimmy Olsen. And I know you're sweet on that Lois Lane.
Well, she certainly likes Superman, but I doubt she notices Clark Kent.
Dear, you keep forgetting that they're one and the same. It doesn't matter whether you wear a suit and tie or a blue outfit and red cape. It's who you are inside. You're a good man, Clark. Lois seems to be as sharp as a tack. I guarantee you she's noticed. Give her the benefit of the doubt.
I will. In fact, we're planning to have coffee together. If she remembers.
Of course she will, dear. But as for you, young man, you remember that life isn't just one emergency after another. You need to live and experience the joys that are around you. Don't define yourself as only a hero. Let yourself be a man, too.
You know, Pa always told me that the harvest wasn't only about the grain we loaded and earning a living. He made me smell the fresh-cut hay, sweet as it dried in the sun, and feel the cool spray of water from the irrigators on a hot day. He would just stand there after the sun set and the night dew started to come in, and he'd take a long inhale and just breathe in the farm and the crops and the earth itself.
Jonathan helped me see the same thing when we were just courting.
Thanks, Ma. You've given me a lot to think about.
Oh, Clark. Just don't spend so much time up in the sky. You don't have a life down here on Earth.
I won't, Ma. I promise.
Bruce hadn't expected what Alfred had learned from Richard Drayling during their conversation that afternoon.
Mr. Drayling resigned because he is concerned for his family, sir. He fears for his life and theirs.
What? In what way?
At first it was an offered bribe, a substantial amount of money. Naturally, Mr. Drayling declined. Next came blackmail, which he also brushed aside. Finally, they made overt threats.
Alfred, what are you talking about? Who are they?
Lex Luthor, sir. He has been systematically corrupting your board of directors, getting them in his pocket. Mr. Drayling is certain that most of the others have already succumbed.
And what does Luthor want from them?
Mr. Luthor has bribed or otherwise coerced the directors to pass along crucial Wayne Enterprises research. Several of Luthor Corp's major technological breakthroughs originated in your own divisions.
5 times in the past 6 months, Luthor Corp edged out our bids on large government contracts. Now I know why.
Maybe he had bided his time too long, played his part too well as a carefree heir, only marginally interested in business matters. He was disappointed that Drayling hadn't felt comfortable enough to talk to the son of Thomas Wayne, but perhaps the older man had seen Bruce as part of the problem.
Mr. Drayling resisted Luthor Corp's advances out of respect for your father. When his refusal led to direct threats against his family, however, he could not tolerate the situation. Therefore, his only alternative was to resign. I explained that he should consider giving you the benefit of the doubt, but actions speak louder than words, if you will forgive the cliché.
Starting tomorrow, I'm hiring private security to watch over Drayling's entire family. The time has come to show the board members who's in charge. Once I do some house cleaning, maybe I can convince Drayling to come back.
But first he had to gather his ammunition and investigate exactly what the remaining directors were up to.
As a gracious gesture, Bruce had decreed that anyone who took public transportation was allowed to leave a half hour early on Fridays. His employees had already embraced the habit, and Wayne Tower emptied out as dusk set in. Ostensibly, Bruce was staying behind to work on the donations from the polio benefit. Tonight, though, he had other things to do. After waiting until midnight, Bruce slipped out of his office and made his way down the dim halls. Most of the fluorescent lights overhead were off for the weekend, only a few flickered now, and Bruce moved through the shadows, cloaked only in his business suit. As this was Wayne Enterprises, Bruce could have walked into the sealed records room and requested any folder he liked, but he didn't want to tip his hand. For the moment, he preferred that his inquiries remained unnoticed. Bruce had full knowledge of the building's upgraded security systems. He had, in fact, studied every detail of the plans when he decided to install covert surveillance kits, as well as adding backdoor combinations to allow him to go anywhere throughout the building. He'd also created a master key for himself that permitted access to any of the executive offices. He began with Thompson's. The metal file cabinets were locked, but Bruce picked the locks easily. Recognizing project code names, he skimmed correspondence files, private calendars, and meeting notes, then inspected some of the more problematic categories. He flipped through memos, carbon copies, photostats, and handwritten notes on legal pads, items that Thompson had not even trusted to his secretary. Bruce's speed reading ability was phenomenal, as was his retention, but his miniature camera was faster and more reliable, so he took microfilm shots of the pages that appeared important. He found copies of drawings for the jetpack prototype, body armor, reinforced structural suit, small rocket launchers.
the projects he had quietly initiated as a surreptitious investigation into Superman's abilities. Thompson had collated all of the projects from various divisions, putting the pieces together, probably for delivery to a Luther Corp representative. But Bruce didn't see the smoking gun he needed. Not yet. He prowled through each office one by one. As he dug into their private records, he saw that some of these men had been embezzling the Wayne fortune, while others were using the guise of his legitimate corporation to engage in unsavory or illegal activities. Bruce knew that it was just the tip of the iceberg. He'd spent so much time developing his Batman persona and fighting street criminals that he'd ignored these white-collar thieves right in front of his nose. When he finished with his investigation in Wayne Tower, Bruce returned to the cave with all the evidence he had gathered. He still needed rock-solid proof, not just innuendos. When he challenged the board of directors, he wanted to deliver a coup de grace. He knew that he could find the proof he needed. The night was still young, after all. An imposing figure in black wingtip shoes and a gray suit, Lex Luthor stormed down the corridor of his Luthor Corp munitions factory. Seeing the expression on his face and the angry flush that bloomed along his bald pate, even his personal bodyguard Bertram gave him a wide berth. He finally arrived at the closed door of an employee lunchroom. Two straight-backed guards stood outside.
We didn't want to do anything until you got here, Mr. Luthor.
At least someone is thinking.
He flung open the lunchroom door. Lois Lane sat in an uncomfortable plastic chair, looking completely relaxed. She had served herself coffee from the percolator. Luthor took a moment to let his rage dwindle to a semblance of calm. On the lunchroom countertop sat thermoses, packs of cigarettes, lunch pails. When the whistle blew in an hour, workers from assembly line number 5 would pour into this room, gobble their food, relax for 15 minutes, and return to work. Like drones, they performed their tasks adequately day in and day out, but people like Lois Lane made Lex angry. Seeing him, Lois flipped open her notepad and gave him an icy, expectant smile.
Ah, Mr. Luthor! Thank you for seeing me at last. As you know, I've been trying to get an interview for some time.
How did you get inside, Miss Lane? This is a heavily guarded industrial center working on U.S. military contracts. Did you fail to see the no trespassing signs?
Did you fail to read my numerous requests for a meeting? Our readers want to know what you're up to.
The American public has no business looking into my private affairs.
The American taxpayers have every right to know how their money is spent. The defense of the United States is hardly a private affair.
Since you've infiltrated this facility, I gather you've seen with your own eyes that we are manufacturing new models of tanks, artillery shells, and missile components for the Defense Department.
She had this camera, Mr. Luthor.
Luthor opened the back of the camera and removed the film, unspooling it into the light.
I'm afraid your photographs didn't turn out, Miss Lane. A shame.
He let the exposed film drop to the floor, where someone else would clean it up later. He leaned closer, placing both hands on the lunchroom table.
Are you a communist spy, Miss Lane?
That's a good one. Let's not waste this opportunity, Mr. Luthor. You're a very powerful man, and like most powerful men, you're also very mysterious. Daily Planet readers want to hear all about one of Metropolis's most influential citizens. For instance, you often go on secretive trips to undisclosed locations. Why is that?
American taxpayers aren't entitled to know my social schedule. That's why I own a private jet. Miss Lane, I'm not a rich playboy bachelor like Bruce Wayne. I'm not a celebrity, and I'm not some man of steel. I'm just a business executive making a living.
I'm sure no one would mistake you for Bruce Wayne, Mr. Luthor, and certainly not Superman.
That's all I have time for, Miss Lane. I'm a busy man, and my hard-working employees will be going on their shift break in a few minutes. Gentlemen, please escort this woman off the property. Oh, and Miss Lane, that notebook will have to remain here along with the camera. This is a top-secret classified facility. America's security is at stake.
The burly man grabbed her arms, and for a moment it looked as if she would put up a fight.
There's also a fundamental American right at stake, Luthor. It's called freedom of the press.
Shouldn't a woman your age be married, Miss Lane? Having children, starting a family? You aren't getting any younger, you know.
Oh.
Once they had disappeared down the corridor, Luther's composure began to crumble. Extracting his handkerchief, he wiped a single bead of sweat from his smooth brow. He was greatly relieved that she'd seen only the assembly line, the tanks, the large caliber artillery guns, the missile nose cones. If she'd managed to get one floor higher in her prowling, that nosy harpy would have seen everything.
Well, that went about as well as I expected.
Blanche Rosen had been right on the money. Lois had infiltrated the facility through a delivery dock when all the men had been on their coffee break. She had slipped up the fire escape stairwell and gone directly to the secret rooms. She'd taken a roll of film already, stashed the small canister inside her waistband, and then sneaked to the lower assembly levels where Luther constructed his legitimate munitions for the army. There, she had allowed herself to get caught. Now that he knew he had a weak link in his outer perimeter, Luther was bound to crack down. She wouldn't get inside again, at least not that way. She opened her glove compartment and extracted another notebook, then quickly wrote down everything she could remember, from quotes to details. She hoped that the hidden roll of film would yield enough explicit information about what she'd seen inside Luther's locked control room. The outline of the Caribbean island base, strange military plans, blueprints for exotic, high-powered weapons. She felt in her bones that this could be the story of the decade, hopefully enough to take Luther down once and for all. Thanks to Drayling's revelations to Alfred and the suspicious documents that he had found in their offices, Bruce believed that most, if not all, of the remaining board members were under Luther's thumb. But he didn't believe they were stupid. Arrogant, perhaps. Overconfident, definitely. Some might even be terrified. But they would never leave the truly damning evidence in their own offices. He had to dig deeper to find what he was looking for, and the best time for digging deep was after dark. He'd sifted through all publicly available information about the men and stripped away their first layer of secrets. Then Bruce donned his other identity and slipped out, targeting each man in turn. He would investigate until he had the necessary proof, or until he was convinced a particular man was genuinely clean. So far, no one had fallen into the latter category. Paul Henning, the vice president of manufacturing, owned a nice house in a good suburb of Gotham City. He also surreptitiously rented an apartment under an assumed name. The apartment was convenient, discreet, and readily accessed by his mistress for an occasional rendezvous. At the moment, though, it was unoccupied. The fire escape window in the apartment building had been painted shut. From his utility belt, he withdrew a tiny vial of solvent and applied it to the cracks on the sill, loosening the paint. Powerful magnets on telescoping rods dealt with the latch. With a swirl of his dark cape, he slipped inside, then gently slid the window back into place. Not a single dirty dish in the kitchen sink. Everything neatly in place in the cupboards. Several bottles of bourbon, vodka, and gin stood in a row, with two clean highball glasses and an empty ice bucket. The sitting room contained a plaid sofa, a round table with a lamp, and a large radio. The bedroom held little more than a nightstand and a bed with two pillows and wrinkled sheets. The bathroom was a standard towels, bath mat, medicine cabinet affair. The medicine cabinet yielded nothing.
And it can't be that careful.
Back to the sitting room for a more thorough inspection. The walls were bare. There was nothing in the base of the lamp. He slid the sofa forward and found a central heating vent. But a functional radiator stood plainly against the opposite wall.
This shouldn't be here.
He pried loose the metal grill.
The safe.
Henning had a much deeper secret than the fact that he had a mistress. Donning small earphones from his utility belt, Batman extracted a sensitive gauge, and in 10 minutes he had the safe open. Inside, he found corporate papers, memos, canceled checks, a ledger that revealed numerous transfers of technical documents, and blueprints for highly classified projects that Wayne Enterprises had spent years and millions to develop. Everything had been transferred to Luther Corp. Henning had accepted plenty of bribes, and he had kept track of them all. Perhaps the man wanted his own proof to use against Luther if ever the industrialist double-crossed him, but it was all the proof that Bruce Wayne needed now. Scowling beneath his mask, he reread the details to make certain, took microfilm photographs of each page, and carefully repackaged the contents. Over the next several nights, Batman found more evidence of Wayne Enterprises' projects being transferred. Pending medical breakthroughs, trade secrets that were funneled to Luther Corp. A juicy bribe had turned Henning, blackmail had broken Norlander. Threats to his family had forced Drayling to resign. It was time for the next stage of investigation to begin.
Lois, remember I promised you a cup of coffee? Would now be a good time? We can just go to the coffee shop around the corner. I'd really like to know what you think.
Lois was in a rush as always, but she stopped when she saw the look on his face.
Oh, Clark, you really look out of your element.
That's how I feel. I promise it'll only take a few minutes.
You buying?
Sure.
Then I'm having a Danish, too.
She startled him by slipping her arm through his and steering him toward the elevator. In the coffee shop, she chose one of the stools at the counter rather than the more intimate setting of a booth.
Gee, I'm not sure the advice is good, but I tried to listen to them and respond to how they're feeling. Give them support, one way or another. My mother told me to be compassionate. She said that as long as the advice comes from my heart, then the recommendations can't be entirely wrong.
Lois skimmed the article.
When did you see your mother? I thought she's in Kansas.
I spoke to her on the phone.
Lois's eyes danced back and forth along the lines of text, and he watched her nod slightly to herself. Her smile of approval meant more to him than he could have ever expected.
Not bad, Clark. And I mean that. Not only is it what readers want, but it's good advice, too.
Thanks, Lois. It was so hard to choose which ones to answer among all those letters.
This one's a little thin, though. The man in love with a coworker who doesn't seem to know he exists. I think you should tell him to do little things. He doesn't need to win a football championship or put an end to world hunger. He just needs to open doors, ask for her advice, bring her coffee or a newspaper. Believe me, women do notice these things, whether or not it's apparent to the men.
Thanks, Lois. That really helps.
Your heart's in the right place. Oh, gotta go. I'm after an important follow-up to the Luther story. Thanks for the coffee.
Lois pecked Clark on the cheek and gave him a quick smile.
Good column, Clark. Who knows? You could have a whole new career ahead of you.
He knew he was bright red from blushing. Taking his mother's advice to heart, Clark also made an effort to strengthen his friendship with Jimmy Olsen. The freckle-faced young man was delighted when Clark suggested that they catch a movie after work. Jimmy picked the movie, Flying Saucers from Space, and they sat together near the front, munching on popcorn, sipping cherry cola through straws. Clark stared at the black and white images, watching the enemy aliens with their whirling saucer-like ships, their death rays. Jimmy thoroughly enjoyed it. Clark was troubled by the persistent portrayal of aliens as evil monsters that wanted to destroy or enslave the human race. No wonder many of Lois's readers had been skeptical about Superman's declaration that he was not from Earth.
Whoa!
He had hoped to provide a shining example, to expose the silliness of being afraid of the unknown. But since he knew no other genuine aliens, how could he be sure? The next day, Clark glanced up from his typewriter as a rush of excitement whirled through the newsroom.
Quick! Turn on the radio!
At this moment, fighter jets are scrambling to respond to a strange silver spacecraft that has appeared over Washington, D.C. Witnesses describe it as a flying saucer. It refuses to respond to radio transmission.
Chief, I'm calling my father. If anyone knows what's going on, the general will.
Great Caesar's ghost. He's not going to stop to give interviews in the middle of a national crisis.
He will if he wants to keep getting birthday cards from me.
Gee, Mr. Kent, do you think it's the start of an alien invasion, just like in the movie last night?
I can't talk right now, Jimmy. I'm on a deadline in an hour, and I have to finish my column for Mr. White.
Clark picked up papers and bustled out of the newsroom, while the other reporters gathered around the radio. Red cape rippling behind him, Kal-El streaked through the sky, straight toward the nation's capital. By adjusting his senses, both seeing and listening to radio waves on specific bands, he could monitor the action. Seven USAF F-100D Super Sabre jets had taken off from nearby Bowling Air Force Base, but the unidentified flying object had soared away from Washington, D.C., skimming low to the ground, then looping up into the clouds in a series of impossible maneuvers. The fighter pilots did their best to keep up, leaving vapor trails that Kal-El could easily follow. If this truly was an interstellar ship, it would be capable of incredible velocities. As the sleek elliptical craft raced westward across the United States, it outdistanced the supersonic jets, but Kal-El could fly even faster than that. The UFO raced across the Great Plains, cutting across Nebraska, then headed south. Kal-El wondered briefly if it would arrow towards Smallville. Might a fellow Kryptonian be able to detect someone from his former home in the middle of Kansas? Maybe even the remnants of his crashed ship? Kal-El picked up on the chatter among the jet pilots.
So far, the bogey hasn't launched any bombs or missiles, Cap. Maybe it's peaceful. Over.
Yeah, and maybe it's just here to ask for directions to Venus.
Our orders are to pursue and intercept. We've got no response to our transmissions, so we have to assume that thing means no good. Listen up. When you get in range, fire at will. Acknowledge.
Copy that.
The alien visitor didn't speak English, and I wondered how the spacecraft could possibly respond. He felt a powerful need to reach the flying saucer first, before the fighter jets did anything foolish. These men might unintentionally provoke an interplanetary war.
Sir, there's something coming up on our six. Wait, it's Superman!
Kal-El streaked by, hand raised, cape now a blurry red line behind him as he shot past the lead plane.
Roger that. He'll knock that alien out of the sky.
Maybe so, but remember, he's an alien too. Over.
Eyes front. Where did those other aircraft come from? Over.
Three larger planes now flew on a perpendicular course, peeling out in front of the strange silver craft.
Unidentified aircraft. Please respond and identify.
The new aircraft cut directly across the UFO's path, but the saucer zigzagged, ducked beneath them, and streaked past in an instant. Kal-El scanned ahead, pushing with his enhanced vision to glean information about the three private craft. His X-ray vision penetrated their hulls, and through the fuselage, he discerned pilots, technicians, and engineers working with analytical devices, studying screens. They all wore uniforms with a very familiar corporate logo.
Luther Corp.
What did Luther Corp have to do with the alien craft? Kal-El supposed that someone like Lex Luthor would be fascinated by otherworldly technology. He probably wanted to seize the silver craft for himself, and he undoubtedly had his own equipment, including unmarked supersonic aircraft, so that he could get the strange ship before the military did. Regardless, it was obvious that even these new planes had no chance of catching the flying saucer. Kal-El put on a burst of speed, pulled ahead of the Super Saber jets, and began closing the gap to the UFO. As he raced past, he saw that the men inside the Luther Corp aircraft were activating a kind of pulse beacon from a small antenna. But instead of aiming at the flying saucer, they pointed the spike back toward the oncoming fighter jet squadron.
Mayday! Mayday! Flame out!
Behind Kal-El, the squadron formation broke apart and scattered, with the trailing jets circling away. The lead Super Saber, though, began gushing black smoke from its engines as it tumbled awkwardly from the sky.
All systems foobar! Can't eject! Malfunction! Going down!
The F-100D entered a deadly and disorienting spin, its engines erupting in a blaze of flame. One of its wings shimmied dangerously. Meanwhile, the Luther Corp craft beat a hasty retreat, no longer pretending to chase the flying saucer, and the UFO streaked away in a completely different direction. The remainder of the USAF squadron could do nothing to help their fellow pilot. Their own cockpit systems were also scrambled, and the pilots struggled to keep from crashing alongside their leader. Kal-El didn't hesitate. He had to forget about the flying saucer. He whirled about and dove toward the fallen jet. He filled his lungs and expelled a great gust of air, enough to freeze the engine cowling and extinguish the flames before the fuel tanks exploded. Then, as gently as he could, he took hold of the jet's belly, raising his hands over his head so he could support the falling dead weight, taking away the burden of gravity as he eased the aircraft toward the barren ground below. The Super Saber's systems were completely fried, which prevented the pilot from extending his landing gear. Kal-El brought the jet down carefully on the desert sand, set it on its belly, then tore away the canopy. He snapped the pilot's harness and pulled the man to safety, still concerned that the jet might explode. As he stood on wobbly legs, the pilot removed his helmet.
Thanks, Superman. You saved my life.
Glad to be able to help. I wouldn't leave you stranded.
Kal-El scanned the sky for any silver glint of the saucer, but too much time had passed. The mysterious spacecraft had vanished. He had seen enough evidence, but he didn't have enough answers. Before confronting the members of his board, Bruce decided to go to the core of the problem, Lex Luthor. The industrial magnate's private home was in the Lake District north of Metropolis, an extravagant fortress built along the lines of a military citadel, strikingly different from the stately Gothic architecture of Wayne Manor. Bruce easily found an excuse for a quick trip from Gotham City to Metropolis using his Wayne Enterprises private jet. Charity functions, private meetings with potential donors, maybe even a night on the town. He didn't need to worry about a cover story. Before departing for Metropolis, Bruce studied the blueprints, both the redacted plans on public file and the accurate versions that were supposedly not available to anyone, old and forgotten permit applications and rubber-stamped approvals, the landscaping layout, the architectural elevation drawings. He searched for weaknesses and considered some of the surprises that might be waiting for him. Then, he got himself ready. The ostentatious Lake District homes were surrounded by a comfortable buffer of forested land. Luther's property was encircled by a dangerous-looking wrought iron fence topped with spear points, beyond which stretched a no-man's land of additional fences and booby traps. Any man who needed so much security obviously had something to hide. Bruce Wayne knew that from personal experience. Darkly caped and fearsomely cowled, with heavy traction boots and armored bodysuit, utility belt loaded with a cornucopia of imaginative tools, he began his approach as soon as full darkness fell. Given the perimeter fences, he decided the best approach was from the lake. Fitted with an air mask, he glided forward underwater, creating not even a ripple, a shark now instead of a bat. Luther's mansion had a private dock, but no boat was tied up to it. While closing the distance and shining a small light into the murky waters before him, Batman saw large metal spikes strategically submerged at the property line. These would tear the hull of any boat that approached too closely. The placid surface gave no hint of the jagged tips just underwater. Intent on avoiding these spikes, he didn't see the fine mesh of entrapment wire that snared him. He struggled, but the elastic net drew tighter. Forcing calm, he worked one gauntlet free, produced a wire cutter from his utility belt, with which he made short, methodical work of the lethal strands. He swam free. Gradually, he raised himself above the surface and came to shore. His thick suit had been scratched by the sharp entrapment wire. A normal swimmer would have been sliced to ribbons. He crept up from the lake, careful not to stir the dried leaves or fallen branches at the water's edge. When he reached the spiked fence, he worked his way quietly over and through. Before taking a step, he scanned the ground carefully. He found and avoided four tripwires and a landmine trigger. After conducting careful surveillance for several hours during his preparations, he already knew the guard's habits. While he waited in the shadows, five armed men walked about in a standard patrol pattern. Intimidating, yet inefficient. Predictable. The imposing mansion had sharp angles and plenty of glass, metal, and concrete. It did not at all fit with the natural wooded surroundings. The highest roof sported a small private observatory. This home seemed designed to convey the impression that Lex Luthor had many friends and social obligations, but the mansion was, in fact, virtually deserted. As the midnight hour approached, Luthor's only company was his security team. With his dark cape helping to hide him, Batman circled to the wing that housed Luthor's extravagant second-floor study, which was fronted by a balcony. He suspected that the household safe and Luthor's private records would be there. Withdrawing a sharp-pronged grappling hook, he twirled it, paying out the thin, strong cable. He let the hook fly, and it sailed upward on a gentle, precise arc. The prongs caught and lodged around the stone balustrade. He pulled the cable taut, then braced his boots against the stone wall. He felt acutely exposed and worried that a spotlight might happen to brush across the mansion's exterior. According to their unvarying patrol patterns, he had 40 seconds before the guards returned. He reached the balcony, swung himself over, and crouched in the shadows just as a guard turned the corner, walked past, and continued into the grounds. The French doors of the balcony were locked. The interior lights were low, the room empty. He peered inside, saw no sign of Luthor. On the other side of the mansion, the observatory dome was cracked open, and the telescope within was pointed toward the starry sky. Removing a diamond glass cutter from his belt, Batman scribed a circle in the inset glass near the lock and easily removed the cut section of the French door. He slithered his hand inside and turned the lock, then quietly swung open the door. He would search the offices quickly, take what he needed, and get back out. Since this was Luthor's inner sanctum, past the gauntlet of security measures and a veritable army of guards, Luthor would be most confident of himself here. He had left important papers, files, and objects right there on the desk. After tonight, Luthor would likely be even more paranoid. Sifting through the memos with gauntleted hands, looking at folders and labels, Batman sorted out what he needed. The more he saw, the deeper the conspiracy went. He found files on each member of his board of directors, records of their indiscretions, specific descriptions of how each man had been turned into a Luther Corp puppet, along with notes on the technical data and prototypes they had smuggled to Luther. With his miniaturized camera, Batman photographed everything. After he viewed the next files, his anger grew. The Wayne Enterprises designs that Bruce had quietly encouraged for the sole purpose of understanding Superman's abilities. Luther Corp had put the pieces together into a unified application. He developed a model of armored battle suits, walking robotic armor shells with enhanced muscles, built-in weapon systems, even jetpacks for brief flights. The battlesuit blueprints, though, had been piled to the left of the desk, as if some emergency had preempted all other concerns. The urgent work that occupied Luther was a set of memos and classified dispatches, communiques sent by courier to the White House, to the Air Force, to the chiefs of agencies not generally known to the public. The carbon copy of a memo addressed directly to President Eisenhower sat on top of the stack. In it, Luther demanded that the Air Force release his private property from a secret installation in the Nevada desert. Responses from the Air Force, even from Eisenhower, repeatedly denied any knowledge. Atop a sturdy file cabinet, he found a small cube-shaped lead box next to a stack of printouts, spectrographs, and filtered photos of a crystalline rock. The label on the lead box marked the specimen's origin.
Arakuska, Siberia.
With his attention to details, Batman noted the casual placement of the lead box and the unexpected clutter of the documents. Luther had devoted a lot of recent attention to this specimen. Batman lifted the hinged cover on the lead box to reveal a baseball-sized fragment of a crystalline substance. The irregular-shaped rock emitted a faint emerald glow. Though he had studied geology and could readily identify many types of gems, natural crystals, and igneous, metamorphic, and sedimentary rock, Batman was totally unfamiliar with any substance such as this. A meteorite, perhaps? He looked more closely at the analytical reports. Luther Corp chemists had been unable to determine the mineral's molecular structure, the energy readings, the radioactive emissions, and the character of its refracted light were all highly unusual. Luther's personal handwritten notes produced more questions than answers.
Energy readings exotic, difficult to correlate. Nature of material conveys the possibility of chemical radioactive power. How to release it? Mineral is unlike normal fissile material. Mutagenic properties? Unknown, but likely. Possible uses? Not yet determined. Potential? Unlimited.
More mysteries opening up like Russian dolls. Strange items being held by the government inside a secret military facility in Nevada. Battlesuit prototypes based on proprietary research and development done by Wayne Enterprises. Now a mysterious, energetic mineral specimen from Siberia. Lex Luthor had already stolen so much from Wayne Enterprises, had whisked cutting-edge technological discoveries out from under Bruce's nose. Though this intriguing green rock appeared to have nothing to do with the corruption of the board of directors, perhaps it was something that Wayne Enterprises should investigate as well. It was time to balance the scales. Batman lifted the lead box from the top of the file cabinet.